back to Feel Good Life. This is episode 4 of this new podcast. And today I have with me a very, very special guest. Special to me, it's my boss, my dad, and my partner in crime, I guess, so to speak. I wanted to have him on to talk about a couple of things, kind of to start out reviewing a little bit about the ag industry. And there's been a lot of comparisons lately that 2025 is starting to look like some of the early 80s economically. And so my dad, Marvin Hare, was actually actively farming at that time. And so kind of wanted to get his opinion on that. And then we were going to roll into some changes that he made in his operation to stay in business, basically, and the beginning of what became later on as Delta Soy Food Quality Soybeans Program and business that we run here together. So welcome to the podcast, Dad.
Well, thank you. And I'm really proud of this girl for starting this podcast. I think it's a really good way to communicate nowadays. And anyway, happy to be here.
So you started farming in what year? 1966. So this will be your 50. I can't do math very well. That's not good in my job position, is it?
Yeah, you're going to have to polish up.
I might have to polish up on the addition and subtraction there, but 49th crop.
All right.
59th. I still can't get it right. 59th crop. That is amazing. That's amazing. So you've seen a lot over the years. And some of those down years were in the early 80s. And like I mentioned in the intro, there's been a lot of folks say that 2025 is reminiscent to them of some of those struggling years in the early 80s. What do you think?
Well, it's similar in that the depression or recession in the farming industry in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, was preceded by a really booming time in the early 70s. Farm products were higher priced. There was worldwide trade. Governments were making free trade agreements. Russia was importing huge amounts of wheat. China was coming into the market. We had record high prices for our crops, and so agriculture was booming and land prices going up, farm equipment prices went up. Our farm suppliers realized that they could charge a little more for their products, and they participated in that boom as well. And then a lot of that trade got restricted. Jimmy Carter put an embargo on, and then the boom burst, and compounded for us locally here, at least, a drought in 1980. So even with lower prices, we didn't have much to sell. That really, really just,
like a
just
double,
really hurt.
Double whammy.
Yeah. And then, then it was just, how do we make it, you know? And we didn't just hunker down and tried to spend less money, get less money in the crop. We started trying to improve our irrigation capabilities. We always had irrigation with rice, and fortunately we had the wells and the water, but we just had never really irrigated our other crops. So we started doing those things to improve our yields. Of course, we tried to spend less money for fertilizer, less money for whatever our products were. We were scavenging through farm equipment salvage yards for used parts,
which we still maintain a good supply of around here. We go back to the old stuff every now and then.
And then paying more attention to our records was a big part of it, learning what our costs actually were and trying to chart prices. Our marketing had to improve.
Yeah, I can remember coming in and you would be sitting at the kitchen table with graph paper because, you know, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all the electronic digital age that we do now. And I can remember you sitting there with graph paper and you had, you know, the soybean chart or the corn chart. I don't know what it was at the time. Right. Like soybean chart, rice chart. And he was charting the graphs and everything for the marketing and keeping up with that on his own, which was a lot more time consuming then than it is now. You can just pull it up.
Yeah, you can look at it anywhere, any day, at any time of day.
Shit, yeah, right.
And all the different what am I saying? All the different guides,
And guys,
stochastic, you know,
right.
different ways to analyze the market. And of course, we've got a lot more information now that we get a USDA report every month or two. But we had to try.
Yeah, you had to do a lot of it on your own.
Yeah, you had to dig it out. But that's how you survive. And then, and kind of once we kind of figured that out and got through that, and the interest rates went back down. Of course, we had huge inflation. Interest rates were 15, 16%, and you could get 15% on a CD at the bank. And
Yeah, and we're
who
complaining
had the
about
money to, you know, put in a CD, but it was available.
Of course, we're complaining about our interest rates now at 8, 9, 10%. So we ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, in my career, 6, 7, 8% interest is pretty common
Right. We have
for an operating loan.
certainly enjoyed lower interest rates for a long time. For a long time.
And the mistake that everybody makes is not borrowing all the money you can at 2 or 3% when it's there, and using it and loaning it back to the bank when it gets up to 5 or 6 or 7%, you know. But that's not my business.
So what were some of the good years though? We talked about
Well,
early 80s bad. What were
the
some of
late
the
80s, as we were coming out of that and consolidating, and I can remember even up into the 90s, the early 90s, we were in the mid 90s were pretty good for us. And Jennifer graduated college in 94,
94.
came back to work a farm, and she walked into my office one day, and she had her records from, she was just looking back, reviewing it. She said, "Dad, there's something wrong with these records. So, you know, from about 1982 or one to about 1986 or seven, there's no depreciation." Well, of course, she didn't know, but I just said, "Well, that sounds about right. Everything was depreciated out by then, and we couldn't afford to buy anything new."
And that really hit home for me of how difficult it was. I was a child and remember, that there were hard times. I mean, I didn't really understand the magnitude of it, but looking back at, 24, 25 years old and looking back at those lack, I mean, zero depreciation. There was no piece of any kind of equipment or anything on our operation that could be depreciated because it was already that old and already depreciated out, and we couldn't afford to buy anything new. So I think that's really telling in today's world where a lot of farmers are adding something to their operation almost every year. And it was just certainly a different time and certainly something that farmers today probably can't even imagine, just as I couldn't as a young farmer at that
Well,
time.
the farm equipment manufacturers, the farm suppliers, the seed dealers, chemical dealers, all the things that we need to have to make a crop did the same thing. They had to. We weren't buying anything.
They had to downsize too. So during that time, during that early 80s period, you did a few things on the farm to try and diversify and add value to what you were doing. Let's start talking about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, it was probably, and I'm not sure if I remember, but it was the exact year, but it was 1981 or 1982. I was in Stuttgart visiting with a friend that I had made in college who was working for a seed producing company, a soybean seed company in Stuttgart. During our conversation, I just asked him, I said, "You know, what do you guys got that maybe I could produce for you, some seed or something that you're doing that would add value to my crop?" Because what we
Isn't
were getting wasn't working. So, and he suggested that I raise a really small seeded soybean, a variety that was particularly useful in Japan for a product, a food that they eat that's really a Japanese only, called natto, NATTO. And it's processed there. They soak it and then they spray it before they package it with a bacteria called natto, which they had centuries ago had found on rice straw. And it made a very tasty, very healthful food. So I said, "Okay, I'm going to try some." So I planted, I think, 80 acres that first year. And we put them in our grain bins here on the farm. And then when they were getting ready to start shipping to Japan, they clean them and process them in Stuttgart, load them on barges or on train cars, and ship them to Japan. Did pretty good. Had, I think, at the time, the premium was $1 per bushel. Of course, we didn't have any GMO-type soybeans then, so it just fit right in with our soybean production. All our chemicals worked the same. And cultivators, our directed spray, our harvesting equipment, our planting equipment, everything was fine. And the yields were comparable. So that $1 a bushel premium just really looked good.
Yeah, added a lot of value on those 80 acres.
I raised a few more, a couple of hundred acres. And within about 3 or 4 years, I'd increased to about a third to a half of my entire soybean production, and start getting a little nervous about having all my eggs in one basket. So I went down the road to one of my neighbors, and I convinced him, and he planted a few. And Hart's seed company in Stuttgart, they kept saying, hey, we need more production. We need more production. Can you get us some more production? So I contacted several farmers in the area and contracted some acreage with them. And pretty soon it outgrew my storage. And so I had a friend in a seed business in town in Newport who had some storage that he wasn't using. We started anyway. It just kind of expanded like that. And then at some point, the seed company in Stuttgart was bought out by one of the big large companies, seed companies, and they continued doing this same program. But then about, I think it was along about 2003 or four, this large company decided they didn't want to do this little niche market, Natto soybean anymore. They were in for the big wide, the big market, and they just didn't want to do it for whatever reason. And so one of the executives with that company that was in charge of the Natto soybean portion of their business at that time decided to take an early retirement from his job. And here I am with all my growers and all of the soybean production available. He knew the marketing and where the stuff was sold. So we partnered. And this is 20-something years. 20th crop as partners with Japan America Soybean and Delta Soy. So we had to do some processing, and we didn't have a cleaner, and all we had was storage, and not enough of that. But we had a friend with a cleaning plant, and they cleaned for us for 3 or 4 years, and then their business grew, and they didn't have the place to the time in their annual cleaning schedule to handle our business. And so we built a cleaning plant. We have a spiral separator. We've got a color sorter. We load soybeans, clean, processed, ready for processing in Japan into 20-foot shipping containers here on our property here at where our grain silos are and our cleaning plant is. That's where it's done. And so it's worked out not only for us, because we still produce at least a third of our crop is Natto soybeans. And we have a lot of farmers that I don't know what portions of each one of those individuals, but it's a substantial portion of their income from soybean production. It's a way to survive during hard times. And not only soybeans, but we look at whatever crop we raise. We want to know, is there something we can do to make it worth more? And we've got a chicken manufacturer or chicken producer nearby that has a non-GMO line of chickens. They've got to be fed non-GMO feed. So our corn that we produce is non-GMO corn. We get a substantial premium for storing it in our bins and delivering it to the feed mill at the proper time. So that adds value to our corn crop. That helps keep us in business. We've also gotten into raising a aromatic jasmine-type rice. And it's got a really, really nice aroma to it. Actually, the name is Aroma 22, which was developed by the University of Arkansas Experiment Station. but it adds a premium to that. So it's just another tool, not only to cut costs, but to increase income. And all of those things go together. It's not one thing. You got to do those little things, one thing at a time. And it's not the big dollars. It's the dime and the quarter. And when you get through at the end of the crop and you put all those nickels, dimes, quarters, and dollars in some cases together, and you've paid your bills and you've lived that year, and you pay your bills and you're ready to start another crop because you survived that year. And that's how you do it. That's how we do it.
That's how we're trying to do it
And
pretty much.
we've been successful with it up to now. We're going to see how we do this coming year.
2025 is going to be a challenge for sure.
And
So
things keep changing.
I would say since I've been back in 94, as you said, some of those years in the 90s were good years for us. And then there were some up and downs in the early 2000s, but 2008 in my mind really sticks out because that's when the oil prices went up really high. There was some issues in the rice market, in the world rice market, that caused the U.S. price to be very different from the world price. And I remember we had some hedges that we got kind of caught in on in the rice market that year. But for me, the whole economics of farming really flip-flopped in 08. And we always say, well, it's a new normal. But for me, from 08 on, it has been a new normal. Things changed where our overhead costs, so like 08 and prior, your labor, your insurance, your repairs, those line items in our budgets were always our highest costs. And then after our inputs to our crop actually became our largest line item. So fertilizer, seed, crop protection ended up becoming larger numbers. And that really flipped how we had to look at our management and look at our numbers because it wasn't not necessarily get larger to spread your overhead costs because the larger you got, the higher your costs were because your input costs were the highest. I think that added to our need to add value to our crops and we started seeking out anything that we could grow that had a little bit more premium on it. We got to work a little harder at it and you have to, pay a lot more
Well,
attention to detail.
you earn that
Yeah,
premium.
you sure do. You sure do. You earn every bit of it. And also, though, having the farming operation and our Delta Soy business helps us remain diversified as well, too, and keep our labor busy. And we have some really, really good folks that work with us and partner with us. You mentioned Japan America Soybeans. We have a research agreement with Delta Crop Care out of Indianola, Mississippi, Dr. Trey Coger and his folks that work on our variety development with us. We've been able to reach out and we learn a lot from those people too, I think.
That definitely that. When we just talk about it here, we're hitting the high spots. When you get down into the details, variety development, plant breeding, replicated trials, and the shipping to Japan, all of that, getting our product to our customer. Fortunately, we have a really good Japanese trading company that takes it from our scales to the customer. And the learning curve would be pretty steep for us on that. I'm afraid an education is always expensive. There's a lot to earning that premium on these crops. Yeah, we've got trucks going to chicken feed mills. We've got trucks going to rice mills from our storage. It's a pretty good chore just keeping everything juggled,
Yeah, I know
between the
that's right.
farm and the needs of the elevator and the marketing and all of that is a challenge.
I always say that, a lot of big companies, which I think any farm operation that's in business today is dealing with a lot. I mean, to me, they're considered a large company because just the dollars have gotten excessive. And as you mentioned, there's just a lot going on, but we aren't big enough to have everybody in-house. So we don't have an in-house accountant. We don't have an in-house agronomist. We don't have an in-house marketing or an attorney or HR and all those things. And so we really have to partner with a lot of people to help us be successful. And we know, I think a farmer knows a little bit about everything. I mean, they're from plumbers to lawyers, to engineers, probably a little doctorate in medical on there on the side, you know. So I think the ability to interact with other people and other professionals is super important to farmers, or we wouldn't be able to do everything that we're doing, because you can't know everything.
Well, you got to know just enough to know when you need to go get the expert. That's for sure.
No, just enough when you don't know just enough.
Yeah.
Well, when I think back over, of course, this will be my 31st crop. I'm a youngster at this,
yeah,
right?
You'll get it one day.
I'll get it, yeah. So when I look back and I think about a couple of memories of us together on the farm, my first big one was calling home from Fayetteville and saying, hey, Dad, I want to change my major to ag business. What do you think? Is there a place for me on the farm? And being a little bit nervous about what is he going to think, because I'd never really been interested in the farm. So do you remember that call?
Yeah. Jennifer graduated high school. Of course, she was interested in a lot of different things, but she had kind of set herself up to, I think her plan was to get a degree in accounting and then go to law school and see ya,
Arkansas, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And with Washington, D.C. probably in the future somewhere. But it was late October, November. Got a phone call one night, and it was Jennifer. She said, hey, Dad, I think I'm going to change my major. Well, every college student's got to change their major at least once or twice. So it didn't shock me. I said, okay, that's great. You know, what are you thinking? She said, well, I'm going to get a business degree, and then I'm going to come to work for you. And I told her, well, I appreciate the heads up, and I've got a few things I've been thinking I need to do. Just come on. And she did, and she's probably kept us in business, honestly.
Well, I don't know what else to say that. I learned a lot along the way from you, for sure. I think we've made a good team, and especially with all the other family members that have been with us along the way, it's been good. And you know, there's times I've got pictures of us. We only had these small bins out here at the grain. I think like 9 bins, the 8 really small ones. And I've got some pictures of us loading corn out before we had the office and the scales. Of course, there's lots of pictures of us at some Razorback football and basketball games. We definitely have had some good road trips watching the Razorbacks win.
Well, we had some good times while you were in college. I just drive to Fayetteville.
Yeah.
You know, we go to a ball game, eat supper.
Yeah.
I'd get back in the truck and come home the next morning.
Yeah. Of course, it didn't hurt that that was the year that Bud Walton Arena opened and we won the national championship, too. But, I'm sure you were just coming to see me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Basketball had nothing to do with it.
Oh, yeah.
Football.
No.
Nothing. Yeah, no.
You're just coming to see me.
That's right. But it was 3.5 hours from my driveway to the Popeyes. I had it down to the minute.
Right. Yep. And I'd get a good meal, and we'd go watch the Razorbacks win.
There you go.
Good times.
Yeah. And we've done well together here on the farm. It's in good hands.
Well, and I think, too, just from a woman on the farm, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, but I think there's not as much... I never have had aspirations to like run the crew and lead the farm from that perspective. You know, I'm a whole lot more comfortable in my accounting cubicle, crunching numbers and things like that. And so having different areas that we were good at has always been good. We didn't run over each other in our priorities, I guess, and in our talents, probably, so to speak. And I think that's good. In any operation, I guess, whether it's male, female, or all males or whatever, is find your niche, find what you're good at and where you can contribute to your operation the most. And then everybody's better for that, instead of arguing about whose job is what, or whose job maybe is most important, because they're all extremely important.
Absolutely. And then, you know, and when I first started, of course, very small and no computerized accounting, I'm sitting here with a ledger book and a pen, taking care of my accounting, my bookkeeping. As we grew, then there was and we had a need for an office. We had a need for someone who, we had enough job, enough work for somebody in-house to do it all. Of course, I had accountants and we had lawyers and we've got people to do that I was kind of managing together. But after Jennifer got back, we started looking for a way we could keep records in-house that would give us the information we needed every day, or at least every month. And that every month was what we were looking at then. And it took us, I don't know, 2-3 years of research until we found an accounting program that we felt like was comprehensive enough and detailed enough that we could keep track of each if we needed to know what our cost was in this combine this year, or this tractor, how many repairs we made, what the interest was on the loan that we borrowed, you know, what our costs were on our equipment. We could do it. We had to know what our seed costs were on each crop. We could do it and have it at our fingertips. Now, today, we've even gone to the point where when one of our suppliers delivers a load of fertilizer to one of our fields, when they build that, they send it to us, email to our office, and we know within a day or two what our expenses, what we spent this crop on each crop individually, corn, soybeans, rice, and even on some farms. So all of that keeps us up to date. If we had to send our records out to somebody, we're 2 months away from knowing what our costs are.
Knowing where we are.
And we have a budget, and we look at that budget often. And Greg, Jennifer's husband, runs the farm crew, field crew, along with Dylan, her son. You know, hey guys, we're running a little over budget on so and so, you know.
We need to adjust.
We need to do something else, you know.
So. Yeah, we either need to adjust and get in budget, or we need to figure out which budget number's going down and take the money out of there. Yes, as you know, as fertilizer's going out in the spring, we're keeping up with it we're at least 2-3 days behind, but we know within 2 or 3 days what our costs are, and we're tracking that as the seed and the fertilizer is going out, because those are some of our largest expenses. And if we don't keep them in check,
they go out in a hurry.
Yes, they can go out very quickly. And if we don't keep that in check, we could be way out of budget by the end of May.
And then you got to find out what parts of the other parts of the budget
you're
that
gonna
you haven't
cut.
Spent money on that you're going to have to cut.
Cut. So,
because you can't go over that budget. If you do, you're broke before you start.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, come a long way from hand ledgers on the kitchen table to being computerized and almost up to the minute, so to speak.
And of course, with communications like we've got now, internet, text, email, cell phone in your vehicle or in your tractor, and all of the other modern, I guess, farming things that are available to us, our GPS, our guidance on our tractors. We've got tractors with 2 computer screens in them, keeping track of the seeding rate on the planter and making sure every row's doing what it's supposed to do. And of course, site-specific fertilizer application or applicator.
We're putting the nutrients exactly where it's needed.
It's
amazing, isn't it?
You know, the days of going out and putting out 100 pounds of O30-60 on the whole field, you know. Of course, we soil test, sample our fields every other year, so we're up to date with knowing what our nutrients, what are needed for each crop, and where we sample them every 2.5 acre in that field to get a separate individual knowledge of what's required in that spot.
Yeah,
and it's gotten really,
really,
really
technical,
high tech, I guess you could say.
Kind of amazing in your 59 crops, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Even in 31,
well,
pretty amazing.
I can remember at 15, before I was farming for somebody else, riding in a wagon that at one time was pulled by a team of mules that was being pulled by a 30-horsepower tractor with a little end-gate seeder on the back, scooping seed rice over into that little seeder planting rice. Now we've got the big air drills that are controlled by the guy in the satellite, you know, and it's
placing the seed a lot.
It's way different. I'm not kidding you. Way different.
Well, thank you for being with me here today, Marvin.
Well, I was here anyway, but I'm glad to be here on your podcast. And I'm really looking forward to the next 59 years.
All right. I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to hold you to that for sure.
It's going to be exciting.
Well, thanks for listening today on the Feel Good Life podcast, and I'll see you in the field.